be free. We must be free.
Good evening and welcome to Amanlo, an hour of African current affairs brought to you here at CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. And I am sitting virtually with Doug Miller. I'm Gwen Shulman. And tonight I'm glad to say we're finally fulfilling a promise we made a few weeks ago. And that is that we are going to focus much of the show on the Tanzanian writer Abdulrazak Gurna, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature about 3 weeks ago. Big fat surprise to everybody in the world and to Gurna himself. So we'll give you a little bit of the background on the writer as well as some excerpts of interviews with him so that we all have a chance to explore somebody who up until 3 weeks ago was really relatively little known. Doug, how about you?
Well, you sent me a forward from a friend of yours with an interview, about a 5-minute piece with a young Ethiopian woman named Hermela Aregawi, who's a news reporter and journalist in Los Angeles, being interviewed on the Black News Channel. And she was turning on its head the way the media looks at the Ethiopian struggle and how there's been a real distortion of who's heroes and who's heels in that struggle. So we're going to play her. And then to complement it, we'll play a rebroadcast of a portion from Fareed Omar's broadcast of 18th of August this year, where he talks about those same issues. So we got two perspectives from two points of view around Ethiopia. So stay tuned to Amanla.
Baba Mnane, one for Shaka, but you
Great and delighted surprise of the world and the writer himself, Tanzanian writer Abdulrazak Gurnah, was this year's winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's little known around the world, despite the accolades he's earned for his 30 plus years of writing. And in fact, when he won the prize, he said, and I love this, I could do with more readers. And that certainly looks like what he is about to get. It was also unexpected, because the Swedish Academy has overwhelmingly skewed its awards towards white Western men. To be clear about that, Abdulrazak Gurnah is only the fifth writer from Africa to have won the prize and only the fourth Black writer to have won the prize. The surprise also came from the fact that pretty much everyone believed and hoped that if an East African were to win the prize, it would have gone to internationally acclaimed writer, Kenyan writer Ngugi wa Thiong'o. And there lies perhaps the only little controversy in Gurnah having been awarded the prize. For decades, Ngugi wa Thiong'o has been an eloquent and outspoken voice advocating for literature in African languages. And while Ngugi publishes in English, he's put his money where his mouth is and published extensively in Kikuyu as well. Of the paltry few African writers who have won the Nobel Prize for Literature, they've all been from Nigeria and South Africa and published in English. With this year's prize, the geography has expanded to include an East African writer, but the language has not shifted. So the Swedish Academy has certainly pursued its history of rewarding the primacy of the English language, but this controversy takes absolutely nothing away from the joy in Africa and around the world that has greeted the choice of Gurnah. And those who know his writing well feel it's richly deserved. I personally had never heard of him, and in talking with others, including a number of East Africans, neither had they. However, many others have, and I'd like to point you to the website brittlepaper.com, brittle, B-R-I-T-T-L-E-P-A-P-E-R, because they put together a really nice piece. They interviewed 103 African writers who do know Gurnah's work and gave each of them a paragraph to express their reflections on the choice of Gurnah. It's a very nice piece. So it's also a testament, I think, to the hundreds of African writers out there that we don't hear about. These are all published writers, 103 who are commenting on Gurnah's work. So it's a nice compendium also of both new and old writers from Africa. So you may want to check it out just for that. Abdulrazak Gurnah was born in Zanzibar under British colonialism. The 1960s saw Zanzibar plunged into a period of bloody revolution that ultimately forced Gurnah to flee to Britain with his brother when he was 17. And it's that experience that proved to be the wellspring of much of Gurnah's writing. And he was one of the earliest writers, in fact, to explore the experience of migration, leaving home, sense of dislocation, living on the margins of society and loss. And underlying his writing is the history of colonialism, exploitation, and violence. He's published 10 novels, including Gravel Heart, By the Sea, and his best-known work, Paradise, which is a historical novel set in colonial East Africa. The Swedish Academy explained that they chose Gurna, quote, for his uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism and the fate of the refugee in the Gulf between cultures and continents. Gurna is a retired professor of English and postcolonial literature at the University of Kent in Canterbury, England, where he still lives. And minutes after the prize was announced, he received a 6-minute phone call from the Swedish Academy before he was beset by media from around the world. And in that call, he was asked, in the context of massive population movement around and across borders, often in the context of forced migration, how he saw the division between cultures. And this is what he said.
I don't see that these divisions are either, you know, permanent or somehow insurmountable or anything like that. People, of course, have been moving all over the world. I think this is this phenomenon of particularly people from Africa coming to Europe is a relatively new one. But of course, the Europeans streaming out into the world is nothing new. Centuries of that we've had. So I think the reason it's so difficult for Europe to kind of, for a lot of people in Europe, for European states to come to terms with this is perhaps a sort of, well, to cut a long story short, a kind of miserliness, as if there isn't enough to go around. When many of these people who come out of both need and also because, quite frankly, they have something to give. They don't come empty-handed. A lot of them talented, energetic people who have something to give. So that might be another way of thinking about it. So you're not just taking people in as if they're, you know, poverty-stricken nothings. But, yeah, to think of it as you're both providing succor to people who are in need, but also people who can contribute something.
Back in 2017, Eleanor Wachtel, the host of Writers and Company on CBC, interviewed Gurna. And I'd encourage you to listen to the whole piece. She's just a tremendous interviewer, and you really get a good taste of the man. But tonight, what we'd like to do is play a brief excerpt of that interview that provides some context on his personal background and a brief reading from one of his books. Eleanor Wachtel starts by asking him about the impact of the revolution in Zanzibar in 1964 on him and his family.
Well, it changed everything, really, transformed. It was the biggest event in my life, even until today, I think. But certainly for Zanzibar, it was a very, very, very big thing. For a start, it was violent. Numbers of people killed, imprisoned. It went on for months. Then what we would now call the ethnic cleansing started, people just being forced to leave, sometimes in some cases just being put on the boat and sent off to Oman. This is even before the later stages when people voluntarily chose to leave. Schools were shut for months. I can't remember now. I think it was like for 4 months or 5 months, something like that. All the teachers who were not Zanzibari were expelled. All banks were closed. All businesses were expropriated, etc. It was just everything was either shut down or taken over.
This was directed against which populations?
I think it was directed against everybody, you know, in the sense that all businesses were expropriated, all bank accounts were frozen. I think everybody who had a bank account. More likely, I suppose, it would have been people of a certain class, and quite possibly there would have been a racial dimension in that as well. But the restrictions, I think, probably apply to everybody, unless you, of course, were connected to somebody who could bypass them. In any case, there was something, I think, truly unsettled. And even those who had influence probably couldn't apply it in a kind of regular way. It was just too much havoc. And people with guns wandering the streets who intimidated, who made demands. And this kind of sort of insecurity and uncertainty just lasted for years. even when things kind of calmed down, because everybody was just terrified and nobody was disobeying. So there was no protest in the street or anything like that. Everybody just did what they were told. But still, this bullying and this, it's kind of lawlessness, really, just went on and on and on, particularly against those people who were identified as the enemy of the state, that is to say, those who are not in support of the government. And this would apply to adults, particularly it applied to attractive young women, whether they were married or whether they were not or not. Yeah, it was just quite frightening at times.
So did you and your family feel in direct danger?
Well, my uncle spent several years in prison because he was a police officer. And now and then, as I say, my father's business was shut down, but not in any, you know, nobody came to our house with a gun and said anything threatening to us in person. But, you know, I know of people who were my teachers, say, who disappeared. I certainly know of school friends who also disappeared. And there were also ongoing events where, you know, a member of parliament, I can't remember, I think they called them the Revolutionary Council, on one occasion walked into a mosque and shot 20 people for no reason. There was just this sort of uncertainty, and you did everything you could to avoid provoking things.
Abdulreza Gurna, exile, displacement, and the immigrant experience are central preoccupations of your fiction, including your new novel, Gravel Heart. And I want to talk about the book in a moment, but I'd like to hear more about your own experience, because 3 years after the Zanzibar Revolution, when you were around 18, you left the country with your brother and moved to England. What were your expectations? What plans did you have?
Well, the plan, you know, when you're 17 and a half or whatever I was, you're driven by some kind of recklessness, which you just don't know what you're doing, really. But I really thought that I wanted to do something more useful for myself with my life. And you can think really profound ambitions like that, I think, even when you're 17 and a half or 18. And I thought this would be possible if I studied a bit more, if I got out of the country. I didn't particularly want to go to England. I mean, it wasn't necessary for my ambition, as it were, to go to England. But it was perhaps necessary to leave and find somewhere where I could do more with myself. I don't suppose it's a very strange kind of thing to feel at that age. So that's what I wanted. I just wanted to do something useful with my life, fulfill myself.
Did you have any idea at the time that you might never live in Zanzibar again?
I probably did have that idea, but I certainly didn't know what it meant to think of it like that. So you think one thing at a time, I suppose, or you think, you know, what is in the foreground of your mind is one thing, and what is in the background you keep out of sight while you're pursuing the foreground. But I think I realized that was one of the first things I realized when we arrived in England. Was that, gosh, yeah, I probably will never be able to go back. So it was a strange, almost paradoxical pleasure, as it were. Not pleasure about not going back, but arriving, we've done it. And then at the same time, thinking that that's probably, I won't see those people again, perhaps. So it was a sad moment as well.
And you arrived without visas, with about 400 British pounds between you. But you were able to enroll in school and get jobs and.
Yeah, it was a kinder time.
Yeah, it wasn't because this was also the time of Enoch Powell. I mean, there was also a lot of tension in British society. Enoch Powell's famous, this is a conservative MP, yeah, talking about rivers of blood and very anti-immigration and very incendiary.
Yeah, the climate was like that, but the rules hadn't tightened up yet, so it was still possible. I was there when I actually heard Powell's speech on the radio. It was like about a year or so, maybe 9 months after we arrived, sometime around 1968, I think. But the rules were not quite as as inhumane, should one say, as they are now. Now it will be very, very difficult to do what we were able to do, which was nothing terrible. We just, as you say, enrolled in a college and then asked for permission to stay. And although it required a little bit of persuasion, that permission was granted. And so we stayed and studied. I think the proviso was that we had to report to the police station once a fortnight, which seems a strange proviso.
Yeah.
But I guess...
To show them your homework or something? I mean, just to prove you were being...
I suppose they would then check with the college to see that you're still attending. Whereas nowadays, of course, colleges are supposed to do that themselves and to report to the immigration authorities if students are not attending. Certainly at the university, they have to do that. So, and then after a couple of visits to the police, they said, okay, don't bother coming again. Just like that, you know. But fellow students made fun of you and said annoying and sometimes hostile things. But really, where we were, well, where we still are, because I now still live in the same town, come back to it, it was all kind of just irritating, being shouted at and whatever. I think maybe in other places it was worse. There was no, I didn't suffer any violence. The only violence that I suffered was to my dignity and self-regard and sense of being a human being, as it were. But nobody beat me up or threatened to. Now and then, maybe people might look physical. But it's changed a lot. It's changed a lot. But the hostility was also, didn't have to be bad-mouthing hostility. You could get hostility of different kinds as well, you know. Just people politely being politely hostile, if you know what I mean.
Did you develop a thick skin?
It hurt, but yes, you did. So and also there was more than one of us. So, you know, you kind of helped each other out, said helpful things to each other. And yes, and I suppose just got on with it.
Much like you, the central character in your latest novel, Gravel Heart, arrives in England when he's 17. But Salim's circumstances are very different. I mean, it's about two decades after the Zanzibar Revolution, and Salim goes to live in an upscale London neighborhood with the family of his uncle Amir, who's paying his tuition to business school. Despite this relative security, Salim feels alienated and overwhelmed by the strangeness of life in London. Could you read from the novel? This is the scene where Uncle Amir and Auntie Asha take Salim shopping for English clothes.
Okay. Having completed my studying arrangements to his satisfaction, Uncle Amir took me to Debenhams to select my wardrobe for me, reluctantly accompanied by Auntie Asha, who favoured Marks and Spencer. The clothes I had brought with me were quite unsuitable for the cold, Uncle Amir told me. Thin cotton shirts and terraline trousers, what was I thinking of? You'll freeze your butt off. Uncle Amir preferred that I understood little of what I saw in London, that I needed everything explained and decisions made for me. My opinion was not required on any issue. They bought me a thick light blue sweater, which came up to my chin and wrapped around my neck like a brace, and a navy blue raincoat made of thick, raspy, canvas-like material. It was two sizes too big to accommodate the woolies I would have on underneath. They bought two long-sleeved blue shirts, which looked shiny and cheap and felt slippery. They finished off with a pair of thick, light blue gloves, blue socks and scarf, and dark underpants. Auntie Asha liked blue. As I walked around the store, Uncle Amir and Auntie Asha discussed the clothes, held them against me, debated the colours, and then chose blue, and explained all their decisions to me carefully, if briefly. For the first few months, every day when I left for college, Auntie Asha examined me to see that I had my full kit on, whatever the weather. I wasn't used to the cold, Auntie Asha told me during the inspection. And if I did not take care, I would end up with a bad chill, and then who was going to look after me? This was London, and they were a working family. For the first few months, I had no choice but to dress as if I was on an expedition. The sweater was too hot, the coat was too big, and made me feel as if I was wearing something discarded by one of the giant Englishmen I passed on the pavements. I took off the gloves and scarf as soon as I left the house and stuffed them in my bag. I was a relation they were paying to educate and clothe, so it was only reasonable that they should be able to choose the clothes they were willing to buy for me. I was surprised, though, by the bluntness with which they did this. I realized that I had anticipated something like it, but had not understood the deference and compliance that would be expected of me. I was grateful for their welcome, and did not find their sense of entitlement to dictate to me unbearable to begin with, but I wished they had allowed me to choose less embarrassing clothes. I knew that I would not be able to replace or wear out that raincoat for years, not so long as I was Auntie Asha's and Uncle Amir's poor relation. It felt like a badge of my neediness. Maybe any clothes would have embarrassed me at that time, because the embarrassment lay deeper than what I wore. It was more to do with the overbearing shrillness of the strange air around me. In the third week in September, 3 weeks after my arrival in London, and fully kitted out, I started college. I made my way there in fear and trembling. London terrified me so much. The streets confused me. I could not make them out from each other. The buses and taxis and cars roared past and churned up my gut. The rush of people and vehicles muddled my sense of direction and panicked me. It humbled me that I recoiled with so much anxiety. I felt as if the city despised me, as if I were a tiresome and timorous child who had wandered unwelcome out of the dust and rubble of his puny island shanty into this place where boldness and greed and swagger were required for survival.
So that just about wraps it up for our tribute to Abdulrazak Gurna. But I wanted to mention that in the whole controversy around he's another English language writer and, you know, the focus on that, the primacy of English and all of that is very legitimate. One thing I don't want to get lost in this whole thing is that Gurna came from an Indian Ocean world. And for those of you who have, you know, are from East Africa, know this so well, or the rest of us who maybe have had a chance to visit, it's a very cosmopolitan, rich place with an incredible mixing of peoples, cultures, languages, histories. I mean, the Swahili coast and that whole area, Doug, you've been there, you can speak to this.
Oh my gosh.
Such an amalgam of African, Asian, Arab heritages, you know, a whole bunch of worlds that have come together. Gurna talks about it a little bit himself in that interview, but I like to think of this prize as a nod to that tremendous diversity and cosmopolitanism that makes that part of the world so, so exciting and such a contribution to, well, really to all of us. And he came out of that tradition. And so he's giving us a window on that.
And I'd like to just reinforce what you said earlier about the 100 and plus writers that were interviewed. And they are just a small part of what's going on the continent. It's a huge, rich contribution to the literary scene and much neglected and much overlooked altogether. So I'd encourage people to get out there and read. There's so many things going on. In fact, book reviews coming out all the time. Yeah. Welcome back to Amandla here at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Your weekly news show with analysis and background on what's happening on the continent that you will not get from the mainstream press. And that's what this next article is about. Del Waters is a Washington, D.C. news anchor of the BNC TV, Black News Channel TV, on a program called DC Tonight, a new show. He's interviewing a CBS2 Los Angeles news anchor, Hermela Arigawi, who is an Ethiopian-American of Tigrayan ancestry. Despite being a news anchor for such an establishment media giant, she's taken on a personal role to denounce the reporting by mainstream media, which continues to reflect the dominant narratives with their racist bent about Africa, in this case about the war between the Ethiopian central government and the Tigrayan People's Liberation Force, TPLF. Hermela reflects and articulates very well the frustration of many Ethiopians in the diaspora, and what their frustrations are with both the events in Ethiopia and the treatment of Africa by Western mainstream media. Check out the Twitter and Facebook campaign that she's involved in at Horn of Africa Hub. It should be pointed out that Ethiopians themselves are deeply divided about the politics of their homeland, and that's quite normal for a country of over 100 million people with such diversity of backgrounds. And she points out how that normally gets on well with people intermarrying and living together and surviving together well. So the politics of it are what interfere. And that's where I'm also going to broadcast a piece from Farid Omar, our faithful correspondent from GRILA, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa, last 18th of August, where I asked him a similar question about what is the role of the international actors on the struggle that's going on in Ethiopia today. So stay tuned for both Hermela Arigawi and for Farid Omar's commentaries on what's going on in Ethiopia. Even though events have moved, the context is very important.
Journalist Hermela Arigawi joins us now from Los Angeles. She is an old friend. And Hermela, first of all, without naming organizations, you maintain that somehow we are getting this wrong. And my old friend Randall Robinson said, when you see Africa, always follow the money, follow the weapons. What are we getting wrong about this conflict?
So yeah, Del, much of the Western media is getting it wrong, and I gather it's because they're doing the bidding of the U.S. government. The U.S. government for a long time had a relationship with TPLF, the Tigray People's Liberation Front. They were once rebels during the communist government, and they were backed by the West to come into power for about 27 years, ending in 2018. And it seems that a lot of the Western media is supporting the rebels' narrative because the U.S. wants to support them because that's their way into power. But the majority of the Ethiopian people have said they do not want that group to be in power. They have voted for the current prime minister. So it seems logical that the U.S. should support the wishes of the majority of Ethiopians as opposed to supporting a rebel group that has been fighting the government as well as the Ethiopian people for the last year. And it's been devastating.
You are not the first person of Ethiopian descent that I have heard that same story from. But that being the case, why do you think it is that we are being misled on this particular story? I mean, some of the people that you're talking about are very good journalists. I know them just as well as I know you. So What makes you think you're right and they're wrong?
So I happen to be of the ethnic group that TPLF claims to represent. They originated 40 years ago saying they were going to liberate the Tigrayan people from the communist regime, but they have strayed away from their goal of liberating the Tigrayan people. Tigray is still very much poor. There's not a whole lot that they've done for the very region itself. And it seems to me, I'm actually an outlier among Tigrayans to be able to speak out and say this narrative is not true. The narrative that the West continues to weave is we're so tribalist that we are killing each other because of the ethnicity that we were born into, when in reality, it's not true. Many of us are intermarried. Much of my family is from different ethnicities. And also the Western media seems to want to paint the Ethiopian government as this savage government. Most recently with the airstrikes, they they were pushing the narrative that they were targeting civilians when in fact they were targeting military armaments within the Tigray region. And so it just seems to be trying to weave that age-old story that Africa is just destined to be in war, destined to have famine. The issue with the famine narrative as well is the Western media has been warning about famine for the last year, but they ignore the very things that could lead to famine, which is that humanitarian aid has been redirected to war. 7 UN officials have been kicked out by the Ethiopian government. 2 UN whistleblowers have backed this idea that rogue UN officials are actually helping arm the rebel group that is fighting the majority of Ethiopians and the Ethiopian government. So it seems to me not a genuine effort to actually help the people, but to actually fuel the very war that has killed tens of thousands and displaced millions at this point.
So, Hermela, you and I, as I indicated, have known each other for a long time. You're smart. Where does this end?
You know, I think it's up to the Ethiopian government to end it militarily. Unfortunately, I'm actually so anti-war, but because the armed rebels have continued to move into other regions and so many people have died because of it, it seems like they are not going to give in unless they do give up, and some of the politicians that were not a part of starting this war get to the negotiating table and try to have a diplomatic conversation. But as long as the armed rebels are fighting, the Ethiopian government is going to continue to fight them, just like any government would. Del, this is an example that might actually help your audience understand what this is. It's like the insurrectionists back in January. If they had attacked, like they did, a government entity, and in this case, a military post, which is what the TPLF attacked, and then when the government actually fought them back, every time one of them died, they would say this is a genocide of insurrectionists, right? That's essentially the narrative that the Western media is asking us to believe about Ethiopia. So would you stop and negotiate with the insurrectionists? Likely not. You would defeat them militarily, which is what the Ethiopian government is doing. So hopefully that this will come to a close sooner than later.
Hermela Aragari joining us from the West Coast. And by the way, if she looks familiar, she is. She's very popular out there. But she is not joining us as that in that capacity. She is joining us as someone who is concerned about her homeland. Hermela, as always, thank you very much.
who's invested so heavily in infrastructure in Ethiopia. Of course, the Americans and NATO and their allies all have an interest in what's happening in the Suez Canal and the Red Sea. Where is the status quo on that now? And are they players in this in any way?
China is a player, but I think still a marginal player. There are reports that some drones that were used in Afar State to target TDF forces were actually supplied by China. And there are also talks about Turkey providing drones to the Abiy Ahmed government, even though the Turkish government has also reports of Russian machineries being deployed to provide drone attacks for the Ethiopian military. So Russia can be an actor because last month, Ethiopia signed a defense cooperation pact with Russia. So this is very concerning because the way it looks, if Addis Ababa comes under serious threat, Russia and China may decide to intervene because Russia now has a pact, defense pact with Addis Ababa. With the US, there has been a lot of people, analysts believe that the resurgence of the TPLF is largely due to US support, Western support. So it looks like the TDF received a lot of weapons, which the Ethiopian government claimed that was smuggled from Ethiopia through a humanitarian corridor. So the US, I think, is playing a role behind the scene, supporting the TPLF. And you can even tell by their rhetoric, most of the time, the US will talk about humanitarian crisis in Tigray. Of course, there is a humanitarian crisis, but largely most of the time blame the Ethiopian Abiy Ahmed government for the conflict. But now what the US is doing is it is trying to seize the initiative through diplomacy. But we don't call this diplomacy. They want to seize the initiative through forced diplomacy, because we have seen in the past that the US has the capability in the beginning to effect regime change through diplomacy. So the US is dispatching its envoy for the Horn of Africa. The Biden government came up with a new office, that of an envoy for the Horn of Africa, which means this US envoy, Jeffrey Feltman, will be shuttling across all the Horn of African countries to enforce US agenda in the region. So Feldman will be dispatched to try and force a government to come to bring about a new government transition. Government now initially is trying to seize the initiative through the diplomatic route, through forced diplomacy, of which there will be a lot of arm twisting, of which the outcome will be the formation of a new transitional government that is pro-US and pro-West. But if things get out of hand, the scariest scenario is that US troops are already stationed in Djibouti, and we could see airstrikes, especially drone strikes. We have seen a lot of drone strikes that are taking place in Somalia. It's because the US has a drone base inside Djibouti that it can use anytime to attack targets in the Horn of African region. So the US now is focusing on that forced hard diplomacy to effect regime change. But if things get out of hand, we wouldn't be surprised if they will take military action. Eritrea pulled out of its troops from most of Tigray because from behind the scenes, we heard that they were threatened by the Americans that if they don't withdraw, that the they will conduct strikes, air strikes, drone strikes, and Eritrea had no option but to withdraw, although they have amassed troops alongside the border. So it shows that the threat of military action strikes by U.S. is possible if things don't go their way now. But because the TPLF, which the U.S. is supporting, has the upper hand now, so they are trying to use the hard diplomacy to bring about a regime change in Addis Ababa.
So on the international scene, then, U.S. was not very favorable to Abiy Ahmed. Why was that?
Abiy Ahmed was willing to retain economic ties with the West by implementing some neoliberal reforms, but he wanted a piecemeal neoliberal reforms, but he was not willing to play the card of the war on terror in the Horn of Africa region. He has very little interest in Somalia, the way the TPLF, when the TPLF was in power, the TPLF was used as a proxy force in Somalia to effect the U.S. war on terror inside Somalia. Abiy Ahmed is not willing to do that.
Okay.
Actually, he has good relations with Professor Farmaggio in Somalia. So he want to get out of the war on terror issues, the war on terror and U.S. initiatives. And the U.S., the reason they favor the TPLF is that the TPLF played a very important proxy role during the time they were in power. And because now the U.S. are afraid that their interests are being threatened in the Horn of Africa, they need another proxy, maybe, to bring back the TPLF to play that proxy role in Somalia and elsewhere in the Horn of Africa. So that's why Abiy Ahmed is in trouble with the West. Also, he refused. Abiy Ahmed doesn't accept U.S.-led mediation. Many times, when the U.S. Sent the U.S. aid boss Samantha Power to Ethiopia, she wanted to meet with Abiy Ahmed. He refused, and rightfully so, because she is the head of an aid agency. And so, what's the point of a head of an aid agency to play a official diplomatic role, which said that it's direct interference into Ethiopia's affairs? So he has been very defiant when it comes to U.S. involvement in Ethiopia. So it looks like the U.S. wants him out at all costs.
We've been hearing a lot of news, yes, Farid, about the fall of Afghanistan to Taliban forces and the withdrawal of all the NATO and basically the American occupation. And and I see this event in Ethiopia entirely as significant, if not of greater significance, to Africa than what's going on in Afghanistan right now. How do you put it in perspective?
Given that the U.S. has completely, U.S. and NATO have completely lost the initiative in Afghanistan, I think they will move very hard to protect the Horn of Africa and the Middle Eastern flank. They can see that if Afghanistan has fallen, they may lose control over the Horn of Africa region as well. So what happened in Afghanistan will have serious implications for the Horn of Africa as well. So the U.S. Most likely will try and move more decisively now, given that it has lost Central Asia. It will move more decisively to protect its hegemonic interests in the Horn of Africa and the Middle East, which is under threat with the ongoing conflict in Ethiopia and also unrest across the Middle East. So the geopolitical realignment in Central Asia will definitely and unfortunately have an impact on the Horn of Africa. And so the way it looks is there may be US may try to group and the territory or the region that it may use as a platform to recoup and regroup will be the Horn of Africa. So what happened in Afghanistan may also bode bad for Africa, for the Horn of Africa. And so we are concerned that we may see a lot of US involvement, military involvement, geopolitical realignment in the Horn of Africa as well.
That's really, really sticky, isn't it? So,
yeah.
So much of this goes back to what you're talking about with the change of agenda for the economic development and structuring of the country from a state-controlled, how would you call it, guided capitalism development.
Development state, yeah.
Versus neoliberal, where anybody can come in and invest and do anything they want and privatize and all of that. So is that still the basic underlying conflict going on here?
Yes, because Abiy Ahmed wanted to, when he was trying to enforce neoliberalism, he wanted to enforce it uniformly across Ethiopia, but the TPLF, which was in charge of Tigray, preferred the old model, the development state that was heavily financed by Chinese aid. And because at that time, the TPLF were close allies of China. So that's another layer to the conflict. But Abiy Ahmed, since the conflict started, I think he's trying himself from the West. So he's pursuing a different agenda. And it looks like he's trying to ally himself now more with Russia in terms of military support. And that's why Ethiopia signed a defense pact with Russia. And we don't know where this, how far this defense pact will go. So, and also Abiy cannot continue with the neoliberal project because he's already under sanction by the US. The US, under the pretext of the humanitarian crisis in Tigray, has placed sanctions on the Ethiopian government. The Ethiopian government faces military sanctions, economic sanctions, diplomatic sanctions. So the US has placed all kinds of sanctions against the Abiy Ahmed government. And so there is a standoff now between him and the US.
Laissez-moi m'envoler, laissez-moi m'envoler, laissez-moi m'envoler. me suis envolé. Et on a connu pire, t'inquiète pas, on va pas reculer.
C'est pas grave, t'inquiète pas, c'est pas grave, on va finir par les avoir. On est brave, on va courir jusqu'à la mort pour atteindre nos objectifs, t'inquiète pas, on va les avoir.
On a perdu, perdu la raison, perdu le chemin de la maison. Y'a qu'avec le blé que nous nous plaisons, le diable nous accueille dans sa maison. Laisse-moi m'envoler, laisse-moi m'envoler. Laissez-moi m'envoler, laissez-moi m'envoler.
J'ai perdu la raison, perdu le chemin de la maison. Y'a qu'avec le blé que nous nous plaisons, le diable nous accueille dans sa maison.
Laissez-moi m'envoler, laissez-moi m'envoler. Laissez-moi m'envoler, laissez-moi m'envoler.
Well, that's it for Amanda this week. Thanks for listening. Thanks. Welcome back to it every week. Welcome back, Gwen. Good to have you here with us. And we thank also Fareed Omar for his insights, and for we really appreciate that Abdelrazak Gurna took the Nobel Prize for Literature. Gwen?
That's pretty much it. Please stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium. Africa Unite, Batsilele.
Puisque ça fait plus d'un an qu'on le mentionne, et que de toute façon vous le savez probablement déjà, on a décidé de ne pas vous le dire. Donc, on ne vous redira pas que pour se protéger de la COVID-19, il faut se laver les... On ne répétera pas encore une fois qu'il faut porter un... Et surtout, qu'il faut garder nos... avec les autres. Vous le savez, c'est la meilleure façon de combattre le virus, même lorsqu'on est vacciné. On continue de se protéger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Hi, this is pianist Steve Amiro from the Montreal Jazz Trio, and you're listening to Orange Grove Radio.
Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to Orange Grove Radio. This is the show where we talk about, listen to, and celebrate the very best in Canadian jazz music. Today's episode features an interview with Montreal-based pianist and composer Steve Amiro. His trio, Montreal.